Well, I hope you enjoyed your little cohort experience there, and that you also enjoyed your lunch. I just one health check as far as the cohort's concerned. These people really are deeply radicalized individuals that are leading your cohort, and if they frighten you, my advice is just to hang in there for another day. And don't be put off by the kind of weirdness of them too much. Because you know, as the cult of Life Shapes grows, you too will be weird in a little while. The thing that we're going to do this afternoon is to do a lot of work. Boy, I hope you guys are up for this. Most of you are Americans, so you know a lot about being up for work. Whether it's productive or not, I'm not sure, but you just do a lot of it. And so this afternoon we're going to look at two shapes. I'm going to get various different members of the team to share with us. And the first of those shapes is the semicircle. Now, I have had several experiences through my life that have led me to the conclusion that by and large, I don't really understand how to order my life. The ordering of life is a highly complex affair, it would appear. And when we look to order our lives, we often start by doing this kind of normal and apparently reasonable thing of taking our life down to its component parts and then trying to reconstruct it. The kind of constructionist view of things, which is rather a deductive approach to life. You know, you kind of break everything down into its component parts. Really, I think that that's why it becomes so complicated. That's why it becomes so difficult. What we need to do, I believe, is to look at our life as a whole, look at the rhythms that God calls us to in that life, and once we've got that inductive process and that big picture, the rest of it really makes a lot of sense. I was a youth worker in the inner city of London when I first burned out. I never really as comprehensively burned out again, but on that occasion, I think I'd almost forgotten my own name by the end of the process. I woke up one morning, looked into the mirror, saw an old man looking back. I was 21 at the time. And it wasn't really the visage that caused me to burst into tears. I think it was just the realization that I was really in trouble and I didn't know how to get out. And I just broke down right there and then. And fortunately, I had a pastor, which in England we call a vicar, who understood that young evangelical youth pastors from the suburbs coming to work in the urban areas are almost certainly going to burn out. And so he'd told me that on the first day that we'd arrived. He said, I'll tell you about this and I'll warn you. And he said, you won't take any notice. So what I'm doing is I'm going to put this money in an envelope in my desk. And when you burn out, it'll be your money to get a train ride home. And I thought, oh my goodness, I've come to a nutcase. You know, he's crazy. And of course, 9 months later, I turned up at his door in shreds. And he didn't even let me in. He said, wait there. And he said, it's no good talking to you. Take the money, go home, crash, sleep for a week, then eat for a week, and then come back and we'll talk about it. And that's what I did. So that was my first experience. And really for other reasons, I often use the other story that I go back to regularly as an illustration of Kairos. But it really helped me to reorder my life according to a lot of what it is that we're teaching you. And this occurred when I was a young clergyman. The youth work position was an unordained youth pastor, and then I went off to do some more research and got a job as an assistant in a place called Cambridge, which most people have heard of, in the town area rather than the gown area. There's town and gown in Oxford and Cambridge, and the gown area is where all the college students are, you know, the dreaming spires of Oxford and all of that. This was the town area where ordinary people lived. And I spent a year asking God to do something, and he didn't. Now, I think the reason for that is that I was asking him to do something and had no understanding of the learning circle. I didn't understand the opportunities that God was offering me probably 20 times a day. I saw a young woman on one occasion. She said she'd like to become a Christian. Sally and I took her and said, well, we'll have dinner together once a week and we'll work through some stuff on what it means to be a Christian. And, you know, that later became the Alpha Course. No, I'm joking. But basically, we did our own personal Alpha Course with this young woman, and she became a Christian, and we were all delighted, and then she joined the Baptist church just down the road. So that was a real kind of kicker. And we got to August. We had our first child, Rebecca. She was walking. We got a little home. We had a backyard, which we call a back garden, and we needed to tame the wild animals that were now roaming the backyard in the shoulder-high grass. So I went in there with a scythe, which maybe you've never even seen before, a two-handed scythe, and then got a rotary mower and started, you know, driving out all kinds of strange creatures. And I came across ants' nests, which are the kind that eat small children learning to walk. So I thought, well, I better get rid of them. And just to confirm you in your now realization that the gene pool that I come from is fairly limited, I asked myself at that point, what would my father do? And I wasn't speaking of my heavenly father. I was thinking, you know, what would my dad do? And I thought, I know, I'll get some petrol. Which, for those of you who don't know what that is, that's called gasoline over here. So I went to the garage, found a can, and went back to the ants' nests. And it's the middle of August, which means that it's climbed above the 60s in England, and it's dry on several days. And it was a warm day. I sloshed it around, you know. Couldn't find the matches anywhere. I thought I'd brought them with me. I went back to the house. They were in the most remarkable spot. To this day, I think there was an angel in the house saying, get the matches now! They were on top of a cupboard. You know, I couldn't get them. Anyway, I found them. Went back into the yard, and I mean, I don't know whether you know this, but you don't even have to throw the match. You just have to strike it. And the backyard was on fire. And the trail of fire went back to the gas can, which had a plastic spout, and which was also alight. So I was, you know, at that moment, going through the thoughts of the local paper headlines, you know, the next day, crater found in young pastor's yard, still no sign of the pastor, you know, that kind of thing. And I thought, I know what to do. I'll get it away from the source of heat. So I grabbed the can, and surprisingly, it was hot. So I dropped the can. Now, if you want to make a flamethrower, the way you do it is you get a large can of gas with a spout, and you light the spout. So that's what I had now created. And the flames shot out of the can all over my feet and legs. So now I'm on fire too. And looking around the backyard, all of the health and safety movies that I'd seen at school of those people from the 50s saying, and when you're on fire, what you need to do is to roll on the ground or take a blanket and smother the flame. You know, I'm thinking, there's no blanket. I can't roll around because everything's on fire. So I thought, well, I'll just have to take my trousers off, which to you are called pants. Pants mean something different to us, and I wasn't at that point yet. So I decided to take my trousers off, and I thought the only way to do this, of course, to take my shoes off first. So I flicked one of my flaming shoes off that went end over end into the next door neighbor's yard. Was found as a kind of pool later, having set his yard on fire. And something kind of overcame me at this point, and maybe my religiosity got the better of me, and I just began to pray. And I said, God, please help me. Because I really was on fire, and I really was in trouble. And as I went to get my trousers off, jeans, the flames were gone. I told the doctor later what he did, you know, what had happened, and he said, yeah, but how did the flames burn? I said, well, I don't know. Do you think the gasoline burned out? Or? And he pointed out various people on the burns unit that had got similar stories to myself, but, you know, had no experience of the flames going out. Well, you know, I thought, well, that's close. And I went back to the house, as all Englishmen would in a similar situation, to make myself a cup of tea. And was in the kitchen as Sally arrived back from the walk with Rebecca and a mad dog of ours called Rafferty. And I was just making the tea, and she said, what's that smell? I said, what do you mean? She said, you know, that burning smell. What are you doing? I said, well, you know, just been cutting the grass. And she said, but why is it all on fire? I mean, what do you mean? And I said, well, you know, I had a little accident. And she said, well, what do you... So I told her what I did, and she said, well, are you all right? I said, well, I'm fine. I'm gonna make a cup of tea. She said, let me have a look at your legs. I said, well, why? She said, let me have a look. So I took my trousers off right there and then, and we looked at them, and we were both amazed because I had huge blisters as big as this on my legs, and some of them had already burst, and a big fold of skin hanging off my legs. And I looked at them and thought, I wonder why that doesn't hurt. By the time we got to the emergency room, of course, the pain hits you. The thing about burning of that kind, such a hot flame, is that it kills most of the nerve endings initially, and then eventually it catches up with you. And it was unbelievable. They took me into theater eventually. I got third degree burns. I had infection in the wounds. They had to scrape off all the charred bits and take a large piece of leather from my thigh that would later be used to kind of patch me back together again. And they put me in an isolation unit because of the infection. So I was by myself, couldn't see Sally or Rebecca or anybody else for a week. And it was in that time that I began to say to God, what's going on here? I've been saying over and over again, please do something. And what God said was, let me do it. That's all I heard. Let me do it. And my problem was that I had come to the belief that the issue was how much I did and what I did, rather than what it was that God was doing and how much of that he was up to. And that was a fundamental kairos moment in my life, and has led to pretty much everything that you see now as life shapes. What we're looking at now with the semicircle is a way to order our lives according to the way that Jesus taught his disciples, and the way in which we can read from scriptures God intended people to have their lives ordered, so that we can actually let God do it. It's all very well saying, well, you know, let God do it. But what does that mean? What's the content of that statement? What does it feel like? What does the rhythm look like? Well, that's what we're going to look at right now. So, let's look at John chapter 15, and I'll read to you a large portion of it so that we've got a chance just to kind of marinate in that word for a little while. The only problem with these microphones that go over your ear is that my glasses have to go back there as well, and quite frankly, my ears are too small for two things like that. Okay. John chapter 15. This is Jesus speaking. I am the true vine, and my Father is the gardener. He cuts off every branch in me that bears no fruit, while every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, so that it will be even more fruitful. You are already clean because of the word I have spoken to you. Remain in me, and I will remain in you. No branch can bear fruit by itself. It must remain in the vine. Neither can you bear fruit unless you remain in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit. Apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not remain in me, he is like a branch that is thrown away and withers. Such branches are picked up, thrown into the fire, and burned. If you remain in me and my words remain in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be given to you. This is to my Father's glory, that you bear much fruit, showing yourself to be my disciples. And then, of course, Jesus goes on to speak about what are the effects of remaining in him, and for that matter, what does fruit look like? And it looks like love. Remaining in his love means that we live in that love, loving one another, and learning how love means to lay down your life for those that you call your friends. Well, here's the context. At the end of chapter 14, Jesus has said to his friends in the upper room, "Come, let us leave." That's the last phrase of chapter 14. So Jesus is on a journey. He's on his way through the streets of Jerusalem. They've walked across the flat roof out of the upper room, which is a familiar location for pilgrims to use in any Jewish home. Jewish homes were built, and then their last annex to the home was the upper room built on the flat roof for pilgrims. And so this was not an unusual spot for pilgrims to be sharing the Passover. So Jesus and his disciples come out of the room, go across the roof into the thronging streets of Jerusalem. Remember, maybe 500,000 people have turned up for Passover. The streets are full of people. You can smell roast lamb in the air. You can hear the psalms being sung and said from every window. And as you go through this amazingly vibrant environment, you make your way towards Temple Mount, because Jesus is on his way to Gethsemane on the Mount of Olives. The only way to get there is through the Kidron Valley past Temple Mount. And so as he comes to the temple, overlaid, you'll remember, with white marble from the best marble mines in the world, and then embossed in gold and silver with the symbol of Israel drawn from Psalm 80. I took a vine out of Egypt and planted it in Canaan. Along the castellations at the top of the temple is a vine. And Jesus says, "I am the true vine. My Father is the gardener. You're the branches." He walks past the temple, past the pools where the ritual ablutions of the Jews would take place, on the south side of the temple, where in 6 weeks' time, perhaps the only location available in Jerusalem, where 3,000 people can be baptized on one day. Jesus walks down the hill towards the Kidron Valley. On the right, there's a vineyard, and in front of him are the olive groves. On the right these days is a bus station, which is not quite as evocative as the vineyard. But as they walk past the vineyard, Jesus continues the metaphor. And it's a metaphor that's riven into the very soul of an Israelite. You'll remember that every Israelite is to have his own vine and fig tree. And so part of the symbolism of being an Israelite, part of the symbolism of being a Hebrew, part of the symbolism of being a Jew in the first century was that in your home you would grow a fig tree and you would grow a vine. And everyone would know how to grow vines. And a vine would be taken and planted, and for 3 years would be allowed to grow as a stocky shrub-like tree. Stocky kind of central trunk. But for that first 3 years would not be allowed to bear fruit. Every time the fruiting season came, at the end of the blossoming season, the branches would be cut back before the fruit came. Like Jesus, who came to give himself for 3 years, the fruit was not evident until after the 3 years. Each of the disciples would have understood that those branches that are cut back, the branches that bear fruit, the branches that don't bear fruit, all of them that are cut back and pruned are cut back within just a couple of millimeters of the vine. They would know that during the slow growing months of winter, the vine would grow around the cut back branch, and the branch would disappear. It would abide in the vine. It would be in the vine, gone from normal observation. You just see this kind of stump. And then in springtime, there would be green tendrils that would be supported perhaps on a trellis, a framework behind the vine, or on small little sticks that look like crutches. And the green tendrils would grow, and because they were supported, would be able to hold the fruit that would come after the time of blossoming. The fruit would be allowed to stay on the branch because this would be fruit that abides. This is fruit that remains. This is fruit that lasts, remember. It's not like fruit on an apple tree, which if you leave it there will rot. This is fruit on a vine, which if you leave it on the vine, is fine. You can leave it there for several months, actually. So it's fruit that lasts, which is something that Jesus refers to in the next few verses. But as soon as you've taken the fruit, immediately you cut back the branch. And so Jesus says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. You know what that looks like. I'm the vine. My Father is the gardener. He's the one that supports the branches. He's the one that cuts back the limbs. I'm the vine. My Father's the gardener. You're the branches. He's called you to bear lots of fruit. Lots of fruit. But unless you remain in me, unless you abide in me, you cannot bear any fruit, even though you're called to have a lot of it. And what is fruit? Well, fruit, clearly, is the multiplication of the DNA of the particular organism that we're talking about. That's what it means. Fruit means reproduction. It means multiplication. And that's why Jesus says, I love you. You love one another. Keep on loving. There's a simple way to understand that there's love being multiplied among them. But the simplest way to understand it is, of course, that Jesus has multiplied himself into the lives of the disciples, and he's expecting the disciples to multiply their lives into other people. That's the simplest and most direct understanding of what it is Jesus is talking about. Now, here we have a pattern. We have a pattern of abiding and bearing fruit. Jesus says, unless you abide, you can't bear fruit. But I've called you to bear fruit. So we have a pattern. We have a picture, a rhythmic look to what it is that Jesus is describing as the life of a disciple. We abide, and then we bear fruit. And obviously, the implication is that between abiding and bearing fruit, you grow. The branch grows and then bears fruit. And as soon as it's borne fruit, then it's pruned so that it can abide. That's a very simple picture. And yet, it seems as though it's incredibly difficult for us to get a hold of. Our understanding of success, i.e. fruitfulness, is to do with growing and growing and growing and bearing fruit and growing, and then growing some more and bearing fruit, and then bearing fruit and growing some more, and then bearing fruit and growing. And yet Jesus says, every branch that bears fruit is pruned so that it can abide, and unless you abide, you cannot bear fruit. And so I've worked with who knows how many pastors and leaders over the years. It's always interesting to me when leaders say, I don't get it. It seems as though God's against us. It seems as though it doesn't matter what we do, nothing's working right now. Well, of course. Isn't that the picture? Isn't that the pattern? Isn't he a gardener? Aren't you the branch? Isn't Jesus the vine? Aren't we expected to abide? Well, yeah, but I mean, you don't know who it is I work for. Well, what do you mean? Well, you know, my boss. Well, who do you mean? Well, you know, my boss. Yeah, but who's your boss? Well, you know, that awful guy who pays me. Well, I think the Father's the gardener, actually. And he's going to cut your branches off just as soon as you bear fruit. And he's not doing it because he's mean, and he's not doing it because he's awful to you. He's doing it because he wants you to bear more fruit, idiot. So what we've got to do is to get in on the program and understand that God's not against us. He's for us. But there's a rhythm to life. And there's a rhythm to individual life, and there's a rhythm to corporate life. And we're not going to get it by living the dream and going for it. Well, let's just do a little bit of biblical detective work and pick up this word fruitfulness. Because quite clearly that's an important word that we can follow through Scripture. It's a much easier word to follow through Scripture than, say, abide or remain, because then we would have to tie ourselves in pretty much to the analogy that Jesus is using in this final parable that he's offering to his disciples. But the word fruitful is a very common word through Scripture, and quite clearly, Jesus knows his Old Testament. So don't do that one to me and say, well, is it the same thing? Yes, it is. So what we've got to do is to go back to where fruitfulness is found in the Old Testament. And the interesting thing is that it's found on the first page of the Bible, depending on how long your footnotes are. Here we go. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Genesis chapter 1, verse 26. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So, God makes human beings in his image. The word for that is he leaves his imprint on us, remembering that obviously image at the time that this was written would not normally be identified with reflection, because mirrors have not yet been invented. So we're not talking about the reflection of God seen in a human being. We're much more saying the imprint of God is left on us as he's made us. And of course, the imprint is part of the story of us being gathered up out of the dust and made out of the... God's own hand. He's made us and left his fingerprints on us. He's made us and left his imprint on us. And the imprint of his hand is intended to always have his hand in it. If his hand is not in the imprint that has been made, then we feel empty. We feel devoid of the most important presence in our life. And of course, that's the story of chapter 3. So he's made us with his image, and the very first thing that he says to us is, the very first word spoken over humanity at our creation is, be fruitful. Isn't that amazing? Be fruitful. Now, fruitfulness is more than procreative activity, because there's obviously a delineation in this, because he says, be fruitful and have kids. So there's an understanding about fruitfulness that is wider than just having babies. There's a call upon humanity to produce something. And of course, that would be consistent with us bearing the image of God, because God has just produced the cosmos. And he's calling upon us to be co-workers with him to continue the process of creation, to continue the process as creatures of taking the stuff of the world and making something, being productive. In fact, in chapter 2, verse 15, it's articulated very clearly. He says, now, Adam, here's the garden. I want you to work it and to take care of it. Work it and take care of it. In other words, productivity is deeply connected with work. We work and we're fruitful. Now, there's an important thing here for everybody who's thinking about retirement, and that is, retirement is subhuman. And I'm not suggesting that anyone here is less than human. I'm just saying that the calling of humanity is to always work. It doesn't change. We're always supposed to work. We're not maybe supposed to be employed to do certain things all the time, but we're always supposed to be doing intentional activity that we'd normally call work. Secondly, drawn by implication from here and from the parables of Jesus, I think it's fair to say that there's going to be work in heaven. Because work is what it is to be a human being. And although our humanity will be fully redeemed and will be part of a new creation, the new creation has a connection to the old creation. In other words, the new creation is gathering up what was lost of the first creation and making it new. Human beings are supposed to work. And out of work, we're supposed to be fruitful. Now, I tend to pause a little while if I'm among a postmodern congregation at this point. Because, you know, this is not a popular message. But amongst boomers like you, you kind of go, yeah, okay, got it, good, tick that one off, check, good, next box. Well, the next box is this, chapter 2, which, incidentally, everybody Generation X and younger really understands. Chapter 2 is this. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in their vast array. By the seventh day, God finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Now, inconceivable is it not that God, having created human beings with his imprint upon them, and that human beings should always stay then within the reach of his arm, it's inconceivable, is it not, that God rested on the seventh day and Adam and Eve worked. It's just inconceivable. So, God's resting on the seventh day, and after a busy day of being created, the sixth day, what do human beings do, having been made to work, to be fruitful? What's their very first experience? To rest. So, here is the fundamental revelation that Jesus is drawing upon in John 15. You are made to work, but you're designed to work from rest, not rest from work. Now, that's not just a clever play on words. That's a fundamental revelation of God's creation revealed in Scripture. Human beings are designed to work from a position of rest. not rest from a lot of work. If that's the design specification of humanity, guess what would happen if we got it backwards? You'd get America. Which is tremendously provocative and almost addictive in its vibrance and pioneering entrepreneurial youthfulness, but is mad and getting sicker and sicker by the day, and is suffering all kinds of collective and individual maladies created by stress and overwork. Is it not? Well, we're not designed to do that. And if you keep on running a car in first gear, it will break down. If you keep on running a car in reverse gear, you're going to crash into other people as well as breaking down. So, what are we supposed to do with this? Well, I think we're supposed to take it on to begin with and allow it just to squeeze us a little bit, because if you're like me, then right now Kairos moment is opening up. Right now you're beginning to think, okay, stop talking right now because I don't want any more. You won't be able to ignore this bit. Or, you know, kind of put it in a compartment under mystic spirituality that I'll get to eventually. Well, here's another little thought for you. Let's just go to the second book in the Bible, in chapter 20, and let's look at God's 10 words. Now, you don't have to look it up. I mean, you know what's there. God says, these are the 10 words. These are the boundary markers for our covenant relationship. And one of those boundary markers, one of the 10 words, is this. Take a day off. And if you don't, then you've broken my law. And this is what it means. It means that not taking a day off is as bad as murder. Maybe not socially, but certainly individually. If you don't take a day off, it's as bad as stealing, committing adultery, coveting the goods of other people. You're thinking, man, I wish I'd have done all the others now. You see? Do you hear it? This is what God's saying. He's saying this is really, really important. This is not just one of those kind of, you know, moderately important things like the Reformation. This is fundamental design specification. This is creation ordinance. Man, woman, day off. Creation ordinance. Yet, we never teach it anybody. We don't live it. We don't disciple people with it. Our churches don't reflect it. Does your church have an abiding time? Or just, you know, there's not many people around in the summer? Well, I know there are not many people around in the summer, but why not teach it as part of the abiding time? Do you have abiding time personally, individually? Do you choose in your corporate life to challenge the culture of which you're part by offering to them some good news, which is, it doesn't have to be this way. People can produce more by doing less. Are we prepared to stand and risk our job by offering a witness to the Babylon captivity that we're in by saying to those that are our masters, well, I tell you what, let's try it out for a little while. And if we're worse than those guys in a few months' time, then we'll do what they did. Like Daniel did, remember? In his Babylonian captivity, he said, well, you know, I can't do that stuff, but why don't you let me do what I do, and if we're not better off than those guys, then we'll just go and do what they did. You know, people have said to me, we've taught this for years, and people have come to me and said, you've no idea, I mean, I'm part of this corporation, and it's kind of mad. And it's taken up every part of my life, and, you know, my family are a kind of an adjunct to my work. And I said, well, leave. If you have an opportunity to be a freed man, then why be a slave? I said, well, you know, I understand. I said, okay, well, why don't you witness then? Said, what do you mean? What do you mean? Tell them what the good news is. You don't have to work all the time to produce just as much. Do you know what? This is so important for American Christians. This is gospel. This is gospel. This is good news. This could transform thousands of lives. It could transform thousands of churches. Because we could start seeing fruit because we choose to abide. Jesus says, you cannot bear fruit unless you abide. And you're called and appointed to bear much fruit. So who would give up much fruit simply because we're choosing not to abide? It's almost psychotic, isn't it? Well, you'll say to me, okay, give me some biblical models. Okay, I will. Let's, if you force me, let's look at 1 Kings. That's all right. Of course, I can't find it. Here it is. 1 Kings. And let's look at 1 Kings 17. Now, honestly, I could do this with anybody, any of the main characters in the scriptures, be they male or female, but I'll choose Elijah because we've done one on Moses, you know, the Ten Commandments, and Elijah was one of the other guys who turned up at the Transfiguration, so my assumption is he's quite important. So in other words, if he's quite important, he's probably a person to model ourselves on in some degree. I didn't turn up at the Transfiguration, so you don't have to take anything that I say, but take some... Now, Elijah the Tishbite, this is 1 Kings 17. Now, Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, as the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word. Now, I've said this before, but there are no records of Elijah having a prophetic word up until this point, which for me is astonishing. Can you imagine this is your first prophetic word? I mean, just think about it. You know, I spent years teaching people how to listen to God and what it is that he might be saying to you, and then, you know, you can hear that for yourself and then you can share it with other people, and we do contemplative prayer and Lectio Divina, and, you know, all that, and there's this prophetic thing, and you know, the first picture is, I can see a waterfall. What do you think that means? And it means, who knows? You know, we there's always a waterfall there for the first picture, and, you know, great. Maybe a rainbow. That's great too. But it's generally not at the same level and substance as, it's not going to rain for 3 years. If anybody ever did that, can you imagine? Very first word. It's not going to rain for 3.5 years unless I say so. Fantastic experience. I know I'm stopping you for a minute, but we had a fantastic experience. Me and Paddy... My mother had just died, and I was down to do a parish weekend for a large church down in the south of England, and Paddy said to me, he said, you're going to be fried, aren't you, going down there with your mum just dying? And he said, I'll come with you. So we went down, and they said, well, we want you to teach us how to listen to God and stuff. And so we did a little thing about that, and One of the church wardens, who I suppose in an American situation would be one of the officers, one of the lay officers of the church, important kind of person. She was a delightful lady with a really strong Cockney accent. She stood up. She said, "I think I've got a word from God." We said, "Oh, great. I see a picture of geese flying in a V." And, you know, everybody's kind of listening, and me and Paddy are thinking, okay. "And the geese are flying in a V, and the leaders are at the front of the V. And the leaders are breaking wind so that the others can fly behind. And the others are honking to encourage the leaders to break more wind." Now, at this stage, me and Paddy are absolutely, absolutely hysterical. I mean, it's impossible to hold ourselves in. You know, our face is red and everybody in the room is going. And she said, "I think God is saying we have to encourage the leaders to break wind more often." Fantastic. And, you know, after laughing for three quarters of an hour, we then kind of spent some time thinking about that, and actually, it was really a word from God. Because the leaders really did need to take up the cudgels of leadership and lead the people out. But they weren't being encouraged by the people to do it. So it was a really fantastic word, but, you know, as a first word, it wasn't, "It's not going to rain for 3 years unless I say so." Do you see what I mean? So, this is a significant prophetic ministry I think we can accept. Verse 2, here's the second prophetic word, as far as we can be sure. It's a personal one rather than a public one. "Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah. Leave here, turn eastward, and hide." And he tells him where to hide and what to do when he gets there. Isn't that interesting? Just been launched into the most significant prophetic ministry in the Old Testament. So much so that it's the model of the prophetic ministry in the Old Testament, as the law and the prophets symbolized by Moses and Elijah. And this is a very, very important person. And so, what does God do at the beginning of his ministry? Tells him to don't do anything. Do you think that's interesting? Isn't that fascinating? And yet, we launch people into their ministries with job specification, how many hours to work, and then the extra hours that we want them to tithe, or, you know, this is what you get paid for, and this is what you're going to do, or, you know. Let's take Jesus. I know you're not quite convinced. I think you're convinced, but you're kind of prevaricating a little bit in your mind. I can tell by the eyes, they're looking a bit shifty. You think to yourself, if I don't mention this to anybody, nobody will ever know, so I'm going to just keep on going, okay? Think about Jesus for a moment. Son of God, has the words of affirmation and commission in the river. The Spirit descends upon him. Then what happens? He goes into the desert for 6 weeks. What's that about? And here's Jesus. He comes for his first day of ministry. You know, he's called the guys, fishers of men. They go to the Capernaum synagogue. Somebody's screaming at the back. Jesus casts out a demon. People are kind of interested. They go to Peter's house. Peter's mother-in-law is sick, and so obviously, in a group of men, there's nobody to cook. So they heal her, and she gets up and makes the meal for them. And then the whole of the town, that's what it says in the Bible. I mean, I'm not adding anything. The whole of the town is there at the door, and Jesus heals all of the sick and casts out all of the demons. Now, that's an amazing first day of ministry, isn't it? And just think about it. It's astonishing. I mean, I've had demons scream out at my ordination. I had that. I mean, the bishop who didn't believe in demons was really shocked. And I've had that in sermons.
But it's not on my first day. And here's this whole city outside of the door of Peter, and no wonder people like the paralyzed man couldn't get in. I mean, you know, amazing. So what does Jesus do? He spends the first day doing ministry, and then he disappears. The guys wake up the next morning and go, where's Jesus? I don't know. Did you see him late? No, I didn't see him. Well, did you just let him get away? What was it all? So they search the city. You know, having searched the house, they searched the city. They can't find him anywhere. Somebody says, well, I saw a guy walking out into the hills really early this morning. So they go up onto the hills, they find Jesus. Jesus is there praying. They say, Jesus, what are you doing? Revival is taking place in Capernaum. Don't you know we should be hiring the tent, starting the tape ministry, and having a meeting morning and evening every day? You know, this is what everybody's been waiting for. And Jesus said, let's go somewhere else. Mark chapter 1, 35. Let's go somewhere else. Amazing. Isn't that incredible? Where would he have got that information from? He definitely wouldn't have got it if he stayed at the coalface, would he? He wouldn't have got that if he'd have stayed with his, as we'd say in England, his nose to the grindstone. He wouldn't have got that if his modus operandi was work until you drop. He'd still be a revival preacher in Capernaum. Luke 5:16 says, but Jesus was often found in lonely places praying. Often found in lonely places praying. In other words, the pattern that was established on the first day of ministry, which was, this is all beginning with rest. This is all beginning with retreat. This is all beginning with returning to God. All of it is continued throughout the rest of his ministry. That there is a rhythm and a pattern and a picture. And that rhythm is found in creation. That rhythm is found in lots of different things that we see in the lives of the saints throughout Scripture. So, why is that pattern not in our lives individually and collectively? It must be for some reason other than it's in the Bible. There's got to be a reason for it, and I think we really need to ask ourselves that question. Because Jesus says, unless you abide in me, you cannot bear fruit. Unless you retreat with me, you can't bear fruit. Unless you return to me, you can't be productive. I'm going to ask a couple of people to share for a little while. Dave and Anne and Paul, if you just come and do a quick, you know, wanna for us. And why don't we start with Dave and finish with Paul? And that means you're the ham, Anne. That's all right.
Well, my story is my wife and I lived in England for 2.5 years. We're originally from the States. And when we first heard this teaching of rhythm of life in the semicircle, it just blew me away. It sounded good. I agreed with it. And living there, it was hard not to actually do it. So I was in charge of youth ministry. And I had been doing the ministry for, I would say, about 6 months. And I had a lot going on. And I was the perfect evangelical Christian. That's everything I did, I was striving. I strived to make the ministry work. I strived to get leaders. I strived to get kids. And one day, walking past Mike's office, Mike said, Dave, when you come in here, I want to chat with you. So I walked in and had me sit down, and he said, when was the last time you took a day off? I talked to Janelle this weekend, and I asked her how things were going. And Janelle said, I haven't seen Dave in a long time. We haven't had a time off. And so he said, I just want to check up on you, see how you're doing. And I said, well, I haven't had a day off really since we moved to England. And he said, you like your job? I said, yeah, why? He goes, you're going to lose it if you don't take a day off. And from there, I said, okay, what do? And he said, the first thing you do is go home, get out a yearly calendar, and put your days off in there. I want you to schedule your vacations for the whole year. And fortunately enough, in England, I had 6 weeks of vacation from St. Thomas's. So I went home, and Janelle and I sat, and we scheduled our 6 weeks of vacation throughout the year. Because the thing was, is if I didn't put those times off in there, I'd just never take them for myself. So I scheduled a time to go on retreat with Mike, and we went to South Carolina. I left the youth ministry behind. I left my team behind. And I just, the whole way over to South Carolina, I said, what? I can't do this. The ministry, what's going to happen to the ministry? And so I came, and we were here. I went back to England after South Carolina. And my team came up, and they said, Dave, you will not believe this. While you were gone, we had 7 new kids give their lives to Christ while you were gone. Plus another 10 who we've never seen before. And I was like, wow, the ministry doesn't depend on me. God was doing something. There was fruit while I was resting. Then a few weeks later, Janelle and I went home for Christmas, came back, same thing. Dave, you won't believe it. 5 new kids, plus we have an Alpha course going, and we've got 30 kids coming tonight. And I was thinking, this resting from, or working from rest, is really true. It's a great principle. So I went into Mike's office. I said, I think you need to give me a sabbatical because the ministry will be much more successful if I'm away from this place. But like Mike has said, I think it is an important principle, especially for us as Americans, to really take that time off because it's God who will do it. It's Jesus. It's not me.
Okay, like an AI.
A company called Marks & Spencer, so that was a nationally known company. My background, although now I am an Anglican, my background is that I'm a Presbyterian Scot, and I believe that some of those folks gave the work ethic to the States, so I want to repent on behalf of Scotland for developing that in you. I was called into ministry, and very clear call, and I'm the type of person that kind of gets a call and follows it and doesn't really kind of think through, and this is what it's going to mean to my life. So I took 3 months off between finishing work and starting theological college, and I played golf all summer, and that's really all I did, which wasn't quite as restful as it should have been, because really I should have been hanging out with God a bit more. But I did the kind of golf thing, and I arrived at theological college. The Ryder Cup was on the weekend I arrived at theological college, and it was in Europe, in Spain, and it looked like Europe was going to win. So I was really glued into that. And I listened to that all the way through the whole of the first afternoon at theological college, went to the chapel service, and burst into tears and basically cried for probably the next year. And the reason was that all the stuff that I had identity in, which was my working life, what I did for the church, what I did for M&S, building a home, doing stuff with friends, but it was all done on doing. And all of that suddenly had stopped because I'd changed this lifestyle into suddenly being a student again. And with all of that being taken away, I was left with a who am I? Because my whole life was based on doing, workaholism. And that was what it was about. So that first year at college, I was trying to learn, or I felt that God was trying to teach me about being rather than doing. And towards the end of my first academic year, I came on placement to St. Thomas's for a month. And I'd chatted it through with Mike and said, you know, I'll be coming up, but I think God's talking to me about being at the moment. And he said, oh, that's great. The time that you're arriving is abiding time. So that's where we just hang. I said, well, what do you want me to do while I'm with you? No, we don't. Just come and play golf. Just come and hang out. Come and play golf, hang out. Yeah, just come and play golf, hang out, meet the people, build relationships, that sort of thing. But no, you're not to preach, you're not to organize any programs, you're not doing it, just come and hang out. Well, I got there on the first Sunday, And what I had been asked to do was to go to all of the four services on that first Sunday. And they started at 9:15, which for me was quite early. I'm not really a morning person. And I got there at 9:10, and I was sitting in the pews thinking, mutter, mutter, mutter. I'm here now for four services. Lord, this is going to be a real stretch. Four services in the one day. Oh. And at that point, the worship group started a song which is called Better Is One Day in Your Courts Than a Thousand Elsewhere. So I got the giggles, because there I've been going, I don't want to be here for a day. And there's this worship song going, Better Is One Day in Your Courts. Oh, and I'm going, yes, of course it is, Lord. Yes, yes, I've got the message now. And then Mike started to preach on John 15 about abiding. And he described the process of abiding is that within the context of a day, a week, a month, a year, we need to have valley time where we withdraw, we retreat into God, into Jesus, and relax and refresh with him before we try and scale the next mountain of activity and adventure and achievement. And he said, the thing is, if you don't have that built into your life, you will try and jump from mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop. And I sat, and as you do that, if you don't do the valley, eventually you will hit a very, very deep valley. Because you haven't processed with little valleys, you'll just hit this huge, deep one. And I sat there and I thought, that's what my first year of theological college training has been. I've hit the deepest valley, the deepest pit I know about, because my life has been about jumping from mountaintop to mountaintop to mountaintop. It's all been about adventure, activity, and achievement, and it hasn't had any of the refreshment, relaxation, retreat part of it. And it certainly hadn't had that as the start point to any work I was doing. And I sat there, and I sat there at the 9:15 service hearing this sermon, and I thought, and God, you really want me to get this message, because I'm now going to hear this four times today. And I think it was about the third service that I went forward to respond and, respond to what God was saying and really to take that on. And I was very, very blessed to then be called to serve in my first church, to be St. Thomas's, so that not only had I heard it at the placement, but then I was accountable to Mike and the other staff team in learning to live it out. And I think it's probably fair to say it took me 2 years to really get what abiding was about. I had no idea what to do in August. I was told abide, and I'm thinking, I don't know what to do. I need to start something. I need to get, what do I need to do? And actually to learn that discipline of taking rest and refreshment, both with people or by myself with God, doing some fun things as well as doing some reading, and realizing that all of the programs had stopped. Everything had stopped in August so that I could actually engage and refresh and recreate with God. And I want to give you a final bit of insight. I come to you here today from rest. Before I came here, I had a 10-day skiing up in Colorado, and we had a powder day. And when I got here, I had a day off, and then I started work. So I can come from a place of abiding to serve you this week.
And because she's a member of staff at St. Thomas's Church, having had 10 days skiing, Anne still has over 4 weeks vacation left in the year. Isn't that fantastic? And it's interesting that during the time that Mike has been leading us as a team at St. Thomas's, we've seen the largest mainstream church in the north of England grow from a staff that are taking 6 weeks a year vacation, allowed to take a day a month retreat if they want to, and through the whole of the summer school vacation, the 4 to 6 weeks period over August, end of July into August, only do half days. Spend the rest of the time at home with their families. The thing with that is, that means it's got to have been God that grew the church, hasn't it? Just a couple of things from my own experience. I've had similar experiences to Dave and to Anne. We've all had run-ins with Mike over work. And he's made it clear to us every time the seriousness of doing that. And my last run-in with Mike over working was when he came back to visit us as a consultant, which is now his role with us, about 2 months ago. And the first thing he said is, my observation is you're working too hard, not praying enough. And it is refreshing, isn't it, to be in a situation where the people that you allow to speak into your life are telling you off because you're working too hard rather than pushing you to work harder. But the thing that I've observed is that it's so far from our natural tendency that unless there's a way of permission to be given into our life on a regular basis, we'll move back to a default of overwork and burnout. We haven't had one example of burnout on the St. Thomas staff team in 10 years. And you know, while being involved in this process of this whole church growing, and that's because we've had a senior leader who's been giving permission and in fact enforcing all the time, taking proper amounts of rest. But one of the things that for most of us is that we don't have someone doing that. And one of the things that we talked about at St. Thomas's is we talk about taking on a discipline of grace, which sounds kind of weird when you first hear it, doesn't it? But a discipline of grace. What that means is, for me personally, I know that if I have to make a judgment call on the minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day cycle of working at St. Tom's, if I have to make a judgment call of, am I going to get that bit of work done or am I going to go and take a rest, my tendency is going to be, I'm going to get that bit of work done. Because I'm really important, and unless I do the work, it won't get done. If the work doesn't get done, the church won't grow, which is my false view. You know, we start to put ourselves into the place of God, don't we, as the primary reason for growth. And so what we do is, we always do the kind of thing that Dave was talking about. We put that in all the time. Generally, we can extend grace to ourselves. We can allow God to extend grace to us when we step back and look at the whole picture. Then we can be quite reasonable. We can look at a whole week and realize that we need to take a day off. And we can look at a whole week and we can realize that we need to prioritize time with our families, time with our friends. We can do that when we're looking at the whole picture. When we're going down into the minutiae of day-to-day responsive kind of practice, responding to the pressures, then we lose that and we move back into overwork. And so one of the things that we've been trained to do as a team is to always step back, look at the whole week, look at the whole month, look at the whole year, and schedule in the time off before we do anything else. So the work from rest is that our whole lives are about the work that God's given us to do. That's an incredibly important thing. But the first thing we do is we schedule rest in. We schedule rest in before we do anything else. And it would be interesting, wouldn't it, for those of you that are senior pastors, to see what would happen, even as a starter for 10, you know, if you gave your members of staff that much vacation a year. That would be a challenge to start with, wouldn't it? How about giving all of your staff 6 weeks vacation a year for a start? Now, that would have some effect on productivity, I'm sure, and I'm sure it wouldn't be a negative one. And there's lots of things like that, aren't there? But the discipline of grace thing has been a very important thing for me. Putting the rest time in before the work in the big picture rather than trying to crowbar it into the small picture when we're under pressure, we're not thinking clearly.
Very good. Thanks, Paul. Paul is now the leader of the city church. St. Thomas's has now gone into two churches. One is the parish church, part of the diocese of Sheffield, and then there's a city church, which is a network church in the city, which is a mission church within the Church of England and within the Baptist Union. And Paul leads that extremely well. So, how do we get a hold of this? Because the first word spoken over you in your father Adam was be fruitful. And that word, like the word let there be light, continues to ring down the centuries because God has not retrieved his creative word. God's creative word still rings in our hearts, be fruitful. The problem is, we don't know how to be fruitful. We don't know how to do it. And so we've got to learn it. And we've got to apply it to lots of different areas. From different times of my life, I've had to travel. And when the kids were small, That was a stretch, because we always used to try to build it in so that it wouldn't put too much stress on the family. We worked out how long I could be away and how long I couldn't. And one of the things that we quickly developed was a thing called Daddy's Breakfast, which meant that the children had time of retreat with me once a week. The three kids got to choose where they went for breakfast each week individually with Dad. And, you know, other people have taken that on. Mal does that between him and Chriselle, so him and Chriselle do the breakfasts between them. But it seemed appropriate for us as a family and for the way that our life was being shaped that I do that. It's interesting, now the kids are 21, 19, and 15, and we've gone from McDonald's to Café Rouge as the location for breakfast. But it's a fascinating thing to me. I went back to England just a couple of months ago, and just before that, the girls were back for Christmas, and both of them said, "Are we going to do Daddy's breakfast?" I mean, it's fascinating, isn't it, that once you get into this, there is a kind of a counterbalancing, not addiction, but attraction. That once we start to build into our life a model and a rhythm that really is consistent with Scripture, we know that we benefit from it. And we look for it, and we hunger for it, and we integrate it more and more into our lives. Just to finish on this, and then I'll let you get into your cohorts, but there are some who would say, well, you know, it's interesting, and these are more of the kind of anal theologians, which I think I am from time to time, who say, well, you know, if this is a creation ordinance, we ought to be able to see it outside of the pages of Scripture. You know, we ought to see evidence of this. And just a couple of things to share with you before we finish. The first is that several nations, usually atheistic nations, those that are institutionally atheistic or accidentally atheistic, like the USSR was intentionally atheistic and France is kind of accidentally atheistic, these both of these nations attempted to remove from the fabric of their society a day off, and they did it, and very rapidly created a context of hugely downturned productivity. Even a country like the USSR said during the Second World War, people need a day off in 1 in 7. It's amazing, isn't it? They did the data, and they realized it just wasn't working. It didn't matter, you know, how much the revolution needed to go all around the world. If people didn't get a day off, it wasn't going to happen. So that's interesting. The other is that in the behavioral sciences, especially amongst those who are developing models of education, there is quite a lot of work that's being done. A man called Holt, who's an educationalist behavioral scientist, has looked at the effects of early life on a balanced adult life, what he describes as a mature life, a life of a person who's able to add to the society of which they're a part, to feel secure and significant within that society, and to develop wholesome and long-lasting relationships. You know, what are the kinds of things that makes a person like that? What are the things that occur in early life? And a lot of his research drew him into the pattern and the rhythm of what occurred in early life. And he put it like this. He said, imagine, if you will, two mothers on a park bench talking to one another. And in front of them, the children are playing on the grass. Now, zero in, focus in on one of the children. She's seen a butterfly. And she is captivated by what she sees. And she sees the butterfly and begins to walk after it, wanting to capture it. And as she walks, she gets further and further away from mother. As she walks away, Holt says, it's as though her little tank of courage is exhausted. And although she finds the butterfly, of course the butterfly flies off, she realizes that there's something wrong. She looks around and her bottom lip begins to tremble, and And she wonders where Mummy is. And there she is, way in the distance, probably 20 yards away, way, way in the distance. And she runs back to Mummy, and she's kind of beginning to cry. And Mummy says, "Well, are you all right? There's nothing wrong with you, is there?" And she's chatting to a friend. And the child grabs onto her mum, and he says, it's as though in the contact, the little tank of courage is filled up again. And the baby sees another butterfly and forgets the past experience and begins to follow it again. And he said, now, that rhythm of adventure and retreat, of exploration and return, is fundamental to the development of a balanced human being. And he says that actually, through life, the swing of the pendulum just gets longer and longer. But ask any parent of 20-somethings, they still come back. They still come back because they need to reconnect and recreate and have their little tank of courage filled up again so that they can go off. And he says, if children are not allowed to adventure but are kept in cotton wool and are never allowed to go beyond the safety of the perimeter of the parent's hand, then the child will grow up not trusting the world and be fearful of it. And so enmeshed families, which are over-controlling of their children, will produce children that are fearful and insecure. On the other hand, children that are only allowed to adventure and not allowed to retreat, children who are left unregarded, even though they're struggling, children that are left to make it by themselves because it'll be good for them, are the children who lose trust in authority figures and nurturing figures and begin to look for other sources of nurture and help, and will not develop balanced, wholesome relationships with other people. What you need is a rhythm. You need adventure and retreat. You need work and rest. You need fruitfulness and abiding. You need the rhythm of life. And you can see it in every person's development. So, here is the question. Is that the way you live? Is that the way you disciple others to live? And if not, or if partially, what steps need to be taken for you to be able to make this journey with Jesus as he models to you how it is that he lives in us still? How do we journey with Jesus and learn how to take on this rhythm of life that allows the call of the Father to be our experience, which is we produce much fruit? Now, it was not my intention, and I don't want you to get the wrong impression by me saying this. I certainly don't want you to go away thinking that this is a exercise in self-promotion. But the funny thing is that the people who are here in this room, who, as I say, have been prepared to spend out of their own money, time, and effort to be here, are people that I've trained in one way or another to work this way. And I wonder whether you're able to say that you have similar fruit. Have you multiplied yourself into the lives of many other people? Have you borne fruit?
Hey,